Welcome to the Dust Off Medic podcast. The views expressed here are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else.
We're going to take care of you, right?
Welcome to the Dust Off Medic podcast. This is Trevor. Today, we're going to be covering the shock hypotension guideline. The critical skill of a flight paramedic is the recognition and treatment of shock in the pre-hospital environment. Today on the show, we have Max, and our clinical expert today is Dr. Ben Walrath. Dr. Walrath, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Ben Walrath. I did my medical training at Rush University. I've been in the Navy now for over 20 years. I am board certified in emergency medicine and emergency medical services. I did my fellowship down in San Antonio. So though I'm Navy, I do bleed purple, and looking forward to talking to you guys today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Walrath, for being here. So I think a good place to start with this podcast is just going over a quick definition of what shock is. So per the Merck manual, shock is a state of organ hypoperfusion with result in cellular dysfunction and death. And the way I kind of remember it is I really put emphasis on inadequate tissue perfusion. So it is not a blood pressure or heart rate or particular vital sign. It is inadequate tissue perfusion. So let's go around the DOD real quick and look at this guideline. Let's start with our standard medical operating guideline for the critical care flight paramedic. This is a rather broad guideline that covers hemorrhage/trauma shock, non-trauma, non-cardiac shock, and cardiac shock. Under hemorrhage and trauma, it's really about optimizing hemostasis, hypothermia management, and then tranexamic acid, moving in kind of the damage control resuscitation guideline. Then moving into non-trauma and non-cardiac shock, it's give a fluid bolus up front, and they recommend 2 liters or 30 milliliters a kilogram IV fluid bolus as needed. So I think really the emphasis there is as needed. And then if there is an inadequate response to fluid therapy, there is a norepinephrine drip at 2 to 12 micrograms a minute in order to maintain a systolic blood pressure greater than 90 and a MAP greater than 65. Then in the cardiac, it really breaks it down into a reference to other guidelines. And then on the bottom, it has some pearls, which we are going to go over in detail later on.
All right. So in the 2019 Ranger Medic Handbook, page 35, they have the general shock management page. And it talks a little bit about hypotensive resuscitation and the principles of not over-resuscitating your patient. And it goes into sort of a discussion about shock assessment, talking about the old ATLS, radial femoral carotid pulse and the associated pressures that I think everyone listening should be well aware that those have been scientifically disproven in terms of a specific point being an indicator of a specific pressure. That's more of an indicator of where your pressure is trending. And then it goes into estimation of fluid and blood requirements in shock and the shock classifications, classes 1 through 4. So not a whole lot of specific information about what you should do to treat shock, just a general overview of, like you were saying, states of hypoperfusion.
And the last one we're going to go over today is the Naval Aviation Medical Treatment Protocol. So under their adult care protocol, they cover shock. And what I find interesting about this is under hypovolemic and trauma, it is a very similar guideline, pretty much almost word for word. Where it gets quite a bit different is under distributive and cardiogenic shock. And just to go over it with you guys who don't have it open in front of you, it's, so under distributive shock, there are 250 ml bolus, may be repeated up to 1000 ml if lungs remain clear. And then from that point, it goes into a pressor, and they actually use a different pressor. They're using epinephrine. They mix 2 milligrams and 250 ml of fluid and infuse at 0.1 micrograms a kilogram a minute to maintain a systolic blood pressure of 90. And they also have push dose pressors in there. And that if you aren't familiar with that, it's drawing 1 mL of the 1 to 10,000, or cardiac epi, it's sometimes called, into a 9 mL syringe of normal saline, and then push dosing 20 micrograms at a time. So there is quite a bit of difference. And they actually, during the cardiogenic, which is their other section on their guideline, they also use epinephrine infusions. So definitely something to take into consideration that you might receive that is different from our guideline.
When I think about trauma resuscitation, I think about ATLS. And ATLS, I think, maybe doesn't have the best reputation in the pre-hospital environment just because a lot of it doesn't apply to what we do and seems to lag a little bit behind what the military is doing for its damage control resuscitation and remote damage control resuscitation. If I'm not mistaken, I believe the 10th edition of ATLS still advocates an initial 2-liter saline bolus, although they have added in that you should be judicious with the saline bolus. But I think in the military, we really sort of push to the forefront early blood resuscitation. Let's dig into this. So the very first thing that we want to know is, what sorts of patients does this describe? How can we tell within the first 30 to 60 seconds of picking up a patient whether or not this patient is in a shock state or is experiencing hypotension? Doc, what do you look for initially when you receive a trauma patient? What sort of raises the hairs on the back of your neck and tells you that this person is big sick?
So great question. And I think especially in the pre-hospital environment, having that clinical gestalt is critical, because in these patients, the more quickly we intervene with the appropriate intervention, the better the patient's going to do. So those signs and symptoms, I think altered mental status is a big one. If you have a patient that's just confused, they're not responding correctly, they're not answering questions, you should be thinking shock. And whether that's their septic shock, whether that's hemorrhagic shock, whatever it is, one of the areas of our body that are most sensitive to oxygen is our brain. And so when your brain's not functioning correctly, it's, you know, a definite concern are you getting enough perfusion? And if you're not, your natural systems in your body work to protect the brain at all costs, your brain and your heart. So when you see altered mental status, that's probably a patient that's in the later stages of shock and someone you need to be very concerned about and initiate resuscitation very quickly. Things like skin color, diaphoresis, vital signs, are they tachycardic? Are they hypotensive? Do they have delayed papillary refill? Some basic stuff that you can identify shock with some of those other simple signs and symptoms.
This definitely falls in line with what I'm doing practicing the field as a critical care flight paramedic. I call it my quick 10-second bedside assessment, where in a non-trauma patient, I'll walk up, literally introduce myself, take the patient's hand, feel for skin color, condition, temperature, look for eye contact. When I take the patient's hand, I look to see if they kind of grab and squeeze back out of reflex. And I think Dr. Walrath here is dead on.
Well, the other thing that I really want to reemphasize is that the more quickly we recognize disease states and intervene, generally speaking, the better the outcome that the patient's going to have. And, you know, I think that's broadly applicable to most of the patients that we're going to pick up, regardless of whether they're trauma or medical. The onus is really on us and our ability to quickly identify impending problems and intervene correctly and quickly.
Max, you talked about this before. You kind of brought up fluids when you were talking about ATLS. But Dr. Walrath, what are your opinions on fluid in shock patients? How do you use it? How do you titrate it?
So I think it's, again, I'm going to actually back up before addressing fluids. I think for me, and especially when it comes to shock, I'm somewhat of a physiology geek, and I like to think of what's going on, what should be happening, and then what is the pathophysiology that determines the therapies. You can't really talk about shock without considering cardiac output. So we're talking heart rate times stroke volume. And that's why when you look at vital signs of shocky patients, that's the equation that you're looking at. You're looking at how is the body circulating the typical 5 liters of blood volume to maintain a steady flow at the capillary beds to allow that perfusion to happen. So stroke volume, we determine preload, afterload, and contractility of the heart. So how full is the pump? How well is the pump pumping? And then what's it pumping against? I think, again, when you start talking about fluid resuscitation, really what you're asking is, does this patient in their current shock state have a preload problem? And that's, and really, so before we jump into therapy, I think taking that quick moment to pause and say, what is the actual problem? Because sometimes just, you know, blindly pushing fluids will actually make the problem worse. I think, again, anytime you see a patient in shock, you need to first identifying shock quickly is critical. And then running through that quick, whatever your algorithm is to assess cardiac output and where is the issue? Again, is it a, is this a heart rate problem or is this a stroke volume problem? If it's a stroke volume problem, is it preload, afterload, or contractility? And once you've answered that question, that will guide your therapy. So for most of our patients in the military, young, healthy patients in a combat setting, you're dealing with hypovolemic shock secondary to hemorrhage. So hemorrhagic shock, patients typically tachycardic because that's the quickest thing, the response to a reduction in your cardiac output, your body can very quickly secrete adrenaline and jack up your heart rate, and that then matches the cardiac output. And young, healthy people can compensate quite well. What they're actually compensating for in a hemorrhagic shock perspective is a lack of preload. Heart contractility is fine, and afterload is also fine, so is unchanged. So really what you're looking at is how do you fix the preload? And that's where the discussion, the debate, the recent debate over the last 10 years or so on what's the appropriate resuscitative fluid. And I agree with Max. It's the civilian community has been very slow to adopt that blood is the, when we're talking hemorrhagic shock, you need to give someone blood. Pushing, again, we're talking about if shock is hypoperfusion, pushing a bunch of normal saline may fix the numbers, but it doesn't actually solve the physiologic problem of oxygen delivery at the capillary bed. So you're not actually fixing the problem. You're just, you know, putting lipstick on a pig. And that's why we in the military, especially with our experience dealing with a lot of hemorrhagic shock, have realized that some fluids are actually bad. You make the numbers look better, but you actually hurt the patient. There have been multiple studies published, both in using military literature, using the DoD trauma registry, as well as in some civilian sites that have been pushing the pre-hospital blood. And that's where our damage control resuscitation CPG comes out of the JTS. So personally, blood, first, second, third. If you have no blood, if you don't have whole blood, then blood, you know, blood products. Ideally, 1:1:1. If you don't have platelets, which is the next most difficult thing in a pre-hospital setting, then you have packed red cells and plasma. If you don't have plasma, which would be the next thing you wouldn't have, hopefully at least have red blood cells. And if not, then really you have to ask yourself the question, again, focusing on hemorrhagic shock, if I've stopped the bleeding first and the patient's lost so much blood that I need to give them some volume back, and I don't have a good resuscitative fluid like blood, then what are my options? And if all I have is saline, you really have to ask yourself the question, am I doing more harm than good before I push the saline? And honestly, there's no good answer to that. The science doesn't necessarily support one or the other, but I think a small judicious use of 250 to 500 cc's of fluid probably won't hurt. And if you can get, you know, boost the pressure a little bit, it might help push the what blood remains to the tissues. And there might be some value there. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's my two cents on which fluid should I use.
That sounds perfect. So at a trauma patient, we replace red stuff with red stuff. And we should really only be using normal saline, which has a pH of 5.5 in a trauma patient as kind of a last ditch effort. You know, that's definitely not something you want to go to first. Max was talking about that with the ATLS guidelines earlier.
Yeah, normal saline is far from normal, and it does not say normal on the bag anywhere. But now, I would love to hear your thoughts on the use of hydroxyethyl starch or Hextend, since it's still in the TCCC guidelines as of this moment, and it is pervasive throughout the military still. Does it have a role in temporizing a patient? Are the short-term benefits worth the long-term consequences?
So I think Hextend goes in that same category as saline, which is it is not an ideal resuscitative fluid. It shouldn't be considered an ideal resuscitative fluid. But if you have a patient dying in front of you and I have no other options and I'm really throwing the kitchen sink, then, and that's the only thing I have in my bag. Okay, sure. If it's a choice between the patient dying and using Hextend to maybe bump their pressure long enough to get to the next level of care where they might have a more appropriate fluid, then sure, use the Hextend. But I think you're going to see very quickly Hextend being removed from the guidelines because, it again, just like saline, it's not an ideal fluid for different reasons, but wouldn't, again, in theory, it was supposed to help, but I think in actual practice, the evidence is showing that it's not as effective as we hoped it would be. And if anything, it may actually be causing harm.
It would seem that in an evacuation platform, if you are faced with the situation where you can only give saline or you only have hydroxyethyl starch or you have these sort of less than ideal resuscitation fluids, that is a failure to prepare for that mission. I think, you know, if you have a 7-ton helicopter to carry around your equipment, you should have the equipment that you need in order to execute that mission. So I guess that goes back to the medical mission planners before you arrive at your forward operating base or wherever you're staging your medevac out of. But talking about throwing the kitchen sink at a patient, I want to just hit on the use of pressors in a trauma patient. And specifically, there seems to be a little bit of dogma, a little bit of anecdote about the use of pressors in a trauma patient as a last-ditch effort to bring up their systolic blood pressure. Do we look at blood pressure in these patients as sort of a single metric of success? Are we doing our patients a disservice by using pressors? What's been your experience there? What insight can you share?
So again, I don't think there's any question that the intervention that a patient in hemorrhagic shock needs, first, foremost, second, third, fourth, is blood. Anything other than that, you're just trying to buy yourself time until you can get to blood. And so depending on how much blood volume remains in the patient, and how far along the continuum of shock they are, will help determine, you know, whether your pressor, whether a little bit of saline, whether something else is actually going to be effective. Because if they have enough oxygen carrying capacity, you know, if they've lost 2 units of blood, but they still have blood, you know, they still have some blood volume, whatever I can do to make sure we optimize the use of the remaining blood volume, if I can't replenish them back to the full 5 liters that they started their life with, if they're down to, you know, to 3 liters of blood, then what can I do to make sure that 3 liters is working at its maximum efficiency to perfuse the brain, to perfuse the heart? That's really what you're coming down to. So if I can help the body from a physiologic perspective, lock down some of the, you know, provide some peripheral vasoconstriction to allow more central perfusion, and really preserve the key organs, prevent the body from going into multi-system organ failure, the longer I can extend that time frame, the better. So if I can use pressors to do that, to maximize contractility, understanding the real problem is preload. So I'm ignoring the actual problem. If I'm not pushing blood and replacing red stuff with red stuff, then I'm not actually fixing the problem. What I'm doing is providing a temporizing measure to get to blood. So I think pressors have a role, but again, it's at the very end of the algorithm. It's only when you don't actually have blood.
Now, is there a downside to the early use of pressors? Are you doing your patient a disservice if you jump to pressors too early?
I think absolutely you can be. Yes. Again, this is that's not a decision that comes lightly. Especially in a patient in hemorrhagic shock, pressors can absolutely do harm. And you have to consider the use of pressors very judiciously, but with the understanding that, again, you're building a bridge to the appropriate resuscitative fluid, which is blood, but at a cost. I think a better example in the shock states is when you talk about cardiogenic shock. And if I have a patient in cardiogenic shock, say they have an inferior MI or a right-sided MI, and I'm looking at pushing dobutamine because I want to optimize the squeeze of the heart. So I'm pushing a pressor to keep them alive until they can get to the cath lab. But the problem is by giving them dobutamine, I'm increasing their oxygen demand of the heart, and the heart's already ischemic. So I'm actually increasing the area of heart tissue that is no longer going to be viable. But if I don't give it to them, then they're going to be dead. So it's that, again, it's a benefit risk decision. And it's the same thing in the trauma patient. When you are forward deployed, when you're in an austere environment, if you know, even if your medical planners were fantastic and you went out into the field with multiple units of blood, you know, you may use it all. And you may have nothing left. And now you're talking about, hey, how long's my evac time? You know, what resources do I have? What can I do to keep my patient alive long enough to get to the next level of care, to get to the next batch of resources where I can, you know, shift my resuscitative strategy and actually start taking care of them more appropriately when I have blood available. Yeah, to beat the dead horse, blood is the answer in hemorrhagic shock. Unfortunately, we don't always have blood. And that's why we turn to things like saline, Hextend, pressors, whatever else, to try to keep that patient alive, try to keep them with a pulse and a pressure long enough until we can get to blood. And what we haven't really focused on is the first part of this, which is hemorrhage control. It does pushing as much blood as you want into, if you haven't plugged up the sink and it's just going down the drain, you know, I can put in as much, I can have an unlimited supply of blood, but if I haven't plugged up all the holes and all that blood is just leaking on the deck, well, I'm not helping my patient any. So that's one of the things that we absolutely can focus on from a training skill perspective with all of our pre-hospital providers is high quality hemostasis. How do you achieve hemorrhagic control? And what are the things we can do? And I will tell you that, one of the big things that hasn't people, I know people are looking at the ISR, people are looking out here in San Diego, is Reboa, because none of the junctional tourniquets work that well. If it's extremity hemorrhage, we've done a fantastic job of embracing tourniquets as the solution. You've got hemostatic agents that we've tested, that we've looked at. You look at the TCCC guidelines, very clear how you can do wound packing and how we can stop extremity bleeding. But when you talk about junctional injuries, we haven't solved that problem yet. And there are some products out in the market. There are some better than others. But honestly, none of them are that effective. And that's where Reboa is, you know, potentially the solution. But Reboa also comes at a cost, and a huge cost potentially. And it requires a higher level skill set to be able to float that Reboa catheter and know where you are so you're not doing harm when you inflate that balloon. Here in San Diego, we've been using JP6C6 dollars to look at, can we train medics and nurses to float a Reboa catheter safely? I will tell you, there are probably surgeons listening. If surgeons listen to this, they're cringing right now, saying, I don't even want you as an emergency medicine doctor to float a Reboa catheter, much less talking about medics and nurses doing it. But to be honest, I don't know that the science behind Reboa currently exists to say we should be doing it. But if we get to that point where that's the intervention that's going to help save lives, I want to make sure that we can use that intervention as early as possible to achieve hemostasis. Because until we have hemostasis, all the resuscitation in the world doesn't really help.
Do you think that the insertion of a Reboa catheter is achievable in a helicopter?
I think what you guys do in the back of a helicopter is amazing. And you do a lot of things in the back of a helicopter I honestly don't think are possible. I know you guys do amazing things all the time in the back of the helicopter. My personal preference would be if you're going to float a Reboa catheter, you do it before you get in the helicopter, before you start moving. But I have the same opinion of intubating, starting an IV. I mean, any procedure, once you get in the back, just all so many constraints, so many restrictions all of a sudden. So if you can do that before loading the patient, even to the point where what we've talked about is it if a patient who you think might need it during the period of transport, float the catheter. Or at least put in an introducer, so that way, if you do need it, it's already available to you. It's just a matter of inflating the balloon. Again, there's no science to support this. We're not using it widely, so understand this is not evidence. This is not an evidence-based recommendation. But I think it absolutely could be the future for that short transport time, 20, 30 minutes. If I know I have a patient on the ground that, you know, I can't fix, I don't have the definitive surgical capability wherever I am, and I need to get them to the role three or to the, you know, role two that has a surgeon that can do the damage control surgery. If I can float that Reboa, keep the patient alive, that might be the next step in this evolution.
So we're talking about placing, you know, a 7 French or larger sheath into, you know, your common femoral artery and floating this catheter up. The catheter has pressure transducers on it. And so I guess this would take the conversation towards invasive blood pressure monitoring. Do you commonly use invasive blood pressure monitoring for, you know, your trauma resuscitations? Is it necessary? Can you get by with a non-invasive pressure? Or are there other techniques that can be used?
So I think for a trauma resuscitation, invasive blood pressure monitoring is probably less critical. Because really it's just a matter of get the blood in, and, you know, stop the bleeding, replace the blood. There's the science behind it is honestly, I mean, it's pretty rudimentary. We know the problem. We need to stop the problem from being a problem and then fix it by giving blood. But when you talk about other shock states, especially, you know, septic shock, secondary toxicologic reasons, et cetera, that absolutely, I float A-lines all the time because I want, when I'm trying to titrate that pressure, especially when I start talking about starting a second or third pressor on a patient, I'm using the MAP as a target, and I want as the most accurate measurement that I can as I'm titrating up and down at the bedside. In a pre-hospital setting, honestly, our CCAT teams are doing that, but our critical care flight paramedics, if you're talking about rotary wing transports, you're talking about the back of an ambulance, very rarely are you going to need invasive blood pressure monitoring. You don't have all the technology, the high-speed interventions that you need. And going back to traumatic or hemorrhagic shock, I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze.
So we're talking about invasive pressure monitoring. We do see it a bit in the interfacility transport environment, so the post-surgical trauma patient. Is there anything to look for as far as invasive blood pressure in those patients?
I think when you talk about interfacility transport, you're talking about a different patient population, right? And this is, I have this as I'm the director of emergency medical services for Naval Medical Forces Pacific. So I deal with all of the CNI, our Commander Naval Installation Command, all of the paramedics that, you know, at all of our installations. And are the Navy's EMS instructions specifically excludes interfacility transport as a part of EMS? Because rightly so, they identify it as a completely separate mission. It's a different skill set. It requires different resources. So like you're saying, invasive pressure monitoring, not something I typically use in a 911 response, you know, pre-hospital setting, but absolutely it's great information. And if they're post-op and I have it already in and it's providing good information, then, you know, and this is why I think, again, why I think we don't give enough credits, enough respect to our critical care paramedics or our care nurses, because you guys are so adept at so many different things that in the civilian community, they're two totally different providers. You're either a 911 responder or you're an interfacility transport provider. You're not, very rarely do you do both because it's a different skill set. And I don't know that military medicine has matured to the point where we appreciate the difference. So your question about invasive blood pressure monitoring is, I'm sorry to go off on the tangent, but it highlights that point that absolutely invasive blood pressure monitoring, very valuable in the post-operative patient. When you're talking about interfacility transport, you got to get them again, especially in the battlefield, you know, just because I'm at a role two, you know, post-surgical, or I'm trying to get to the role three, or even from a role three coming back home or going to longitudinal. I want to maintain that invasive pressure monitoring. And yes, there's value there. And you as a critical care flight paramedic should have, if you're doing an interfacility transport mission, should know how to use that to optimize your management of that patient.
I want to talk very briefly about the role of point of care ultrasound for shock. So not necessarily performing an EFAST or something like that, but talk a little bit about the role of an IVC measurement under ultrasound and its utility in looking at shock states, and whether or not that's something that's valuable to us in the in-route care environment.
I will tell you that during my EMS fellowship, Colonel Ted Redmond was, if you know Colonel Redmond, we had long debates over ultrasound, and he will tell you that, at least at that time, we disagreed. I think there's value in ultrasound in the pre-hospital setting. He has a lot more experience, to be honest, than I do in the back of the helicopter. And he told me, I don't know if this is a PG rating talk, but he told me I was full of shit, and I trust him. But I will tell you that in an emergency room, absolutely, that point of care ultrasound gives me a lot of great information, and it helps guide my therapy. So when I'm trying to decide, is this obstructive shock versus is this hemorrhagic shock? So is this an afterload problem or is this a preload problem? A quick look at the IVC, and it helps. It might help guide my therapy. If they're in shock state and they're a traumatic patient, and I do a quick EFAST and there's no blood in their belly and there's no other external source of obvious bleeding, then maybe a quick look at their heart and I go, wow, their pericardium's full of blood. This is actually obstructive shock. And so I don't need to continue looking for a source of bleeding. I need to relieve the pressure off their heart. And that's where the ultrasound can be very valuable. There are absolutely other clinical signs and symptoms that you can use to help determine some of this stuff. But at the end of the day, again, the operating environment for where you guys are practicing, you know, out in the field, in the back of a helicopter, in the back of an ambulance, I think having the ability to use an ultrasound and get a good look at the heart, to get a good look at the IVC, it provides information that would be valuable to make a faster decision, one that you can be more confident in the pre-hospital setting. So sorry, Ted, I still think ultrasound is a good modality for diagnosis in the pre-hospital setting.
And just to temper that, sort of drawing a middle line here, we spoke with Colonel Gurney a few weeks ago and talked about ultrasound, and she said that, and this is a quote from her, ultrasound is as good as the operator, but you have to know how to do it. I know that from my time in the ER working there as a paramedic tech. I use ultrasound extensively for IV starts and things like that, just to try to keep my hand on a transducer as much as possible, because it is absolutely a perishable skill. And so I think that any medics out there having discussions with their medical directors about putting point-of-care ultrasound on their helicopters as an additional capability have to understand that there is a significant training burden that goes along with building and maintaining those skills. Any thoughts on that, Doctor?
No, that's absolutely correct. Again, it is a perishable skill, and it's something that if you're not using it on a regular basis, your skill will diminish. And then you can't rely on the information you're gathering. So if you're going to incorporate point of care ultrasound into your toolkit, you need to know how to use the tool, and you need to be comfortable and competent with the tool. Otherwise, it's going to give you bad information, and that's going to lead to patient harm.
And I think looking at our current operational environment, where we're looking right now at transports routinely going over an hour, I think this is a really valuable tool that we could be using for our force. It's really just a question of if we can get critical care flight paramedics trained, proficient, and certified in the skill. And then once they have that, maintaining those skills, I think that's going to be the great difficulty of ultrasound in our environment.
Trevor, do you use ultrasound on the helicopter over there in Vermont?
Oh, we're trying to get our hands on it really bad. We're still setting up a program right now for ultrasound. We've been doing lab values in the field for years, but ultrasound has been tough to get our hands on. And that's talking about my civilian job. Military, it's tough just to get through the acquisition process right now. It seems like they're trying to primarily field it to make sure all the role ones have ultrasound before they're really pushing to us in route care.
And I want to hit on lab values a little bit later. Jamie Eastman was just authored a paper in the Air Medical Journal about the use of iStat and en route care Chem7s, ABGs, and a partial CBC in the management of their patients. And that was a pretty interesting, single center retrospective, small science, but it was still an interesting paper.
I got to say, Max, from my civilian experience using the ISAT, it's hard to imagine what I do now without it. Like my civilian job, I'm routinely transporting patients hours, and especially a lot of these medical patients, I get so much information from those ISTATs, those Chem7s, those gases. It's really proven to me to be invaluable.
Well, since we're on the subject, we know that there are certain lab values that we're particularly interested in trauma. So, for example, ionized calcium, we may want to get an idea of their level of coagulopathy with a PTT or INR. Do you think in sort of the first 30 to 60 minutes of a trauma resuscitation, is there any value to drawing a Chem7, an ABG, or a CBC in your trauma patients? Do you look at those values and do they guide your initial resuscitation?
So to be honest, probably no. I think the one lab value that I would look for in any shock state is the lactate. Because again, that's an indicator of how well you're perfusing and have you gone from aerobic to anaerobic metabolism. But beyond lactate in an initial resuscitation, those lab values don't have a lot of value in that first 20 to 30 minutes. But after that, as I'm starting to tailor my treatment and my resuscitation, then absolutely. That's when you're talking about, hey, I've given you a couple units of blood. Where's your calcium at? Do I need to replenish your calcium? What's your H&H? Because now I'm also looking for, if I've now replenished your blood volume, but you're still having issues with perfusion, well, then maybe this isn't simply a hemorrhagic problem. Maybe there's another reason you're shocky. And I've gotten focused on there was blood all over the floor, so this must be a blood problem. But it's actually, you also took a bunch of, you overdosed on Tylenol as well as cut your wrists, right? So now I've got, from a civilian EMS perspective, you get some of those complicated pictures. The good and the bad of the military setting is, when we're dealing with hemorrhagic shock, it's typically because the bad guys did some harm. It's a fairly straightforward picture of this is hemorrhagic shock and it's just finding all the different places that the damage was done. And then when you start talking about interfacility transport, absolutely, those lab values are critical. Same thing with prolonged field care. Again, if I'm in a urban EMS setting and I'm 5 minutes from the trauma center, no matter where I am in the city, I don't need lab values. The delay in care to run an ISTAT isn't worth it. Just get them to the surgeon. But for us in the field, you start talking about AFRICOM, you talk about distributed maritime operations in PACOM. Now you're talking about, as a medic, having to manage a patient for hours on end, having the ability to check some basic labs is critical. And understanding, just getting numbers, if it's gibberish to you, is meaningless. So that goes back to the training and back to the physiology and back to the pathophysiology and really understanding what you're doing. So just like with ultrasound, just like with any other skill set, drawing lab values is a skill set. And there's no reason to get the information if you aren't going to know what to do with it. So either you need that knowledge or you need the ability to reach back and talk to your medical director, the receiving surgeon, the receiving an intensivist, somebody who's going to be able to help you interpret the data you're collecting and tailor your resuscitation using that information.
Excellent. And in Jamie Eastman's paper, he said only about 9% of the patients that they transported had labs taken on them. But in about 60% of the patients, it resulted in some sort of procedure or intervention or modification of the treatment plan. So it does seem to be pretty valuable in a certain context. But I can definitely see what you're saying about the initial algorithmic trauma resuscitation that's codified in our TCCC guidelines is built for that first 20 minutes of resuscitation where we have to hit key goals. And we're going to give the calcium after, X number of units of blood, because we know it's probably going to be needed, and we'll go check the calcium on the back end once we've stopped the life threats. Do you think that's a good way to visualize it?
Absolutely. I think if you use an aviation reference, right, you have your emergency checklist of these are the immediate action items I've got to do to stop myself from crashing. And once I'm still in stable flight, there's still a problem, but I've stabilized the helicopter. We're no longer nose down. The ground's not approaching rapidly. Now I can look at all my gauges, my monitors, and go, why, what just happened, and where's the problem? And then you could try to tailor your solution to with more information. But that algorithmic approach, one of my mentors in residency training used to always say, no one gets smarter during a code. And I think another one of the sayings is your quality of the care you deliver is going to regress to the level of your training. I think in those situations, having a strong background in the physiology, understanding what's going on is going to help you. And then as you add information, 20, 30 minutes into it, that's when you're ready to think again. In that first 20 minutes, it needs muscle memory. You just need to be doing the things you need to do and know what those things are. And honestly, the complicated thought process happens after that initial algorithm has already been applied. And that's where you need more data.
Yeah, I think I'm going to use that one. No one gets smarter in a code. I think it's a pretty straightforward way to look at it.
Absolutely. So let's transition away from the trauma stuff. I actually want to know what other types of shock would we commonly see in the military population? I know we talked a little bit about obstructive shock and sort of tamponade physiology. Say we pick up that patient with no obvious external signs of bleeding. We complete our EFAST and we don't see blood in the abdomen. What other things could we see in your 18 to 30-year-old healthy, predominantly male population that may be causing this person to go into shock?
I think the next thing that you have to consider is, we said obstructive shock secondary to tamponade, but then the other, in the black box, you think about the tension pneumothorax. Brian Easter's study highlighted that as one of the big three killers in the battlefield. And that's why needle decompression was initially recommended, and we're moving towards finger thoracostomy because we realize needle decompression is not always as effective as we'd like it to be. Putting a hole in the chest and making sure that there's not air accumulating outside the lungs, preventing the lung from expanding, and that's, again, an obstructive shock problem is what's happening there. That would probably be the next most common. Also, you'd have to consider is potentially some neurogenic shock. If I've got a spinal cord injury, thinking to the simple things, again, from a military perspective, anaphylaxis. You know, that's another cause of shock, that someone's allergic to the bee sting, or they get, so it's, again, they're not bleeding out everywhere, but they had some sort of allergen that they were exposed to, that now they have an overwhelming immune response, and they're in anaphylactic shock. So something to consider. Simply hypovolemic shock secondary to dehydration. You know, guys are out in the field for a long time, they're out in hot, arduous conditions. You can end up in a shock state just secondary to that. Even young and healthy people die of cardiogenic shock. Anyone can have an MI. Or it could be, maybe you're dealing with something like a myocarditis. You know, we're in a worldwide pandemic, and, you know, we have young, healthy people getting sick and maybe developing a myocarditis secondary to that viral infection. Similar, you talk about COVID and the hypercoagulable state, pulmonary emboli. You know, massive pulmonary embolus would be another obstructive shock state that you may find yourself facing. So the reality of it is, even that young 18 to 30-year-old population, that's our primary patient population, you need some information about all of those shock states. And the one I didn't mention is sepsis, not necessarily something you're going to see immediately, from a trauma victim, but when you start talking about the interfacility transport mission, or if you just have somebody that gets sick out in the field, hey, maybe that's the ruptured appendix that, they couldn't get to sick call, and they're, in their foxhole somewhere, and now their appendix ruptured, and now they're in sepsis, and that's who you're trying to get out of the battlefield. So I think all of those patients are possible patients that you as critical care flight paramedics may, be faced with. And that's why having a broad differential diagnosis when you see someone in shock is important. And it's why these protocols cover not just hemorrhagic shock, but also non-trauma, non-cardiac, and cardiac shock.
Yeah, and looking back at this guideline, it really is quite broad what it covers as far as hypotension and shock. These are broad differential of diagnoses that it's covering. And I think going back to what you said, it's really important for flight paramedics to use their clinical skills in order to investigate further what exactly is the problem. Because a lot of these things aren't, you really shouldn't be giving 30 mLs a kilogram IV fluid bolus. And some you should, and you really have to be an investigator and make those decisions.
So the pressor of choice for our protocols is norepinephrine, and the dosing range is anywhere from 2 to 12 mics per minute intravenous. Now, other protocols that we saw that we went over earlier in the episode will use something like a dirty epi drip. You mentioned dobutamine, which is, you know, obviously has a very different pharmacological profile. And there are other pressors that are available, you know, depending on where you work or where you pick this patient up. For us in the back of the helicopter, in the type of operational medicine where we pride ourselves on our improvisation skills, looking at the difference between a norepinephrine drip and a dirty epi drip for these patients in shock states, how would you compare and contrast, provided that your epinephrine drip was mixed correctly and you know, we've defeated all human factors involved? What would be the better choice between epinephrine and norepinephrine?
Well, that's obviously somewhat biased since I'm the one who signed the Naval Aviation Protocols as the medical director. But I honestly think those are both appropriate agents to use. And honestly, part of it just comes down to what's in your bag. What is your supply system going to be able to give you? There are subtle differences. I think it comes down to a weight and tube issue. You can only put so much stuff in your bag. And so, you know, having a pressor that kind of does a little bit of everything for the most common causes of shock that you're going to be dealing with. But epinephrine tends to be a little bit more, have a little more agonistic value on the beta receptors. So a little more effect on heart rate, inotropy, whereas your norepi is going to give you a little bit more of a systemic vascular resistance, a little more squeeze on the, a little more vasoconstriction. I think this is probably the biggest effect, and then how that affects your cardiac output, you know, depending on what the cause of your shock state. But I think they're, in general, very similar. Actually, one's kind of a derivative of the other. So you're getting to the same point. They're both having a beta agonist effect, and that's really what you're looking for. Is again back to that cardiac output, heart rate times stroke volume. So trying to increase contractility of the heart, locking down the peripheral vasoconstriction, so I can get central perfusion rather than peripheral perfusion.
I think one of the greatest quotes I've ever heard about epinephrine and why epinephrine is, it's physiologic. You're using it as an adjunct to the body's naturally produced catecholamines. Like, and I think it's, if you don't know what's going on, I think it's a very safe and effective pressor to use.
I agree with that. From a toxicologic perspective, using epinephrine, it doesn't need to be broken down. There's no enzymatic action required. So not knowing what if you have an unknown, undiagnosed, you have someone in a shock state and you have no idea why, you don't know what they've been exposed to. Like you said, it's the physiologic pressor. Using epi, it goes right to the source. So you're not relying on any possible underlying pathophysiologic dysfunction getting in the way of your treatment.
And I'll tell you from my experience dealing with a lot of these sick patients in the transport environment is any unstable patient, I have pushed dose epinephrine ready to go. Because especially on press patients, because you always have to constantly consider, what if my equipment fails? What if this pump fails? Is this patient pressor dependent? And you have to have something ready to go. And in my experience, push dose epinephrine is really great in filling that role.
And it also, again, I think there's a certain amount of cognitive load that as a medic, you only can put so much stuff in your pack. You can honestly only put so much stuff in your brain. And so if you can focus on, you know, one or maybe two pressors and just know that these are my go-to pressors and I know them in and out, fine. At the end of the day, if I deliver the patient alive, and I use this mentality in the emergency room all the time. You know, I'm a jack of all trades, master of none. I'm consulting my intensivist for a reason, because I know this patient needs maybe a little more sophisticated care than I'm providing. And I'm asking them for help. So I'm not, I think the same thing from a medic's perspective, you know, if you can be really good at knowing one or two pressors and then be really good at that intervention, you're going to save lives.
And as a critical care flight paramedic, if you have to know two pressors, you have to know epinephrine and levofed. You have to know those drugs. You have to know how they work, and you have to know how they're dosed. And the big one I'm going to hit on dosage here right now is epinephrine, because for years we kind of got confused with the 1 to 10,000 and 1 to 1,000, and it's been very error prone. And I'm going to tell you guys right now, stop using 1 to 1,000 and 1 to 10,000. Use 1 milligram and 1 ml and 1 milligram and 10 mls. It's the easiest thing you can do as a flight paramedic to help your patients and help prevent errors is stop using those ratios. It's antiquated. Just stop it. All right. I'll get off my soapbox now.
There's one more thing that I personally really wanted to hit on, and that is positive pressure ventilation in shock. On the cardiac side here, it says, consider non-invasive positive pressure ventilation versus an advanced airway, which is pretty common management. We want to be as minimally invasive as we can, be maximally conservative when it comes to taking away a patient's airway. But if our patient, you know, is hypotensive and unconscious and we are concerned about the impending loss of an airway, we're going to go ahead and place an advanced airway and control that airway. But when we transition from the physiological negative pressure ventilation that we have when we're breathing over to a positive pressure ventilation, whether that's BVM or our ventilator, that does have some hemodynamic consequences. Could you speak about those hemodynamic consequences and some things that we should be looking out for when we take the patient's airway and put them on a ventilator?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question and something that I don't know. Again, there's all kinds of debate in the pre-hospital literature about whether medics should be intubating or not intubating. And honestly, it's the wrong question. I have no doubt medics have shown over the years, you absolutely have the skill set to pass a piece of plastic past the vocal cords. That's the easy part. The issue is, the question you're asking is, what ventilation strategy do I need? Your body, you've been breathing, but now you're not going to breathe anymore. You're in some sort of, you're going into respiratory failure. I need to do that for you. And again, for me, from a shock state perspective, it all comes back to that same equation: cardiac output, heart rate times stroke volume. And as soon as I shift you to a positive pressure ventilation, I am challenging your preload. You will have a reduction in preload. So if I am in a preload dependent state and now I'm intubating you and I'm putting you on positive pressure ventilation, I'm going to make the problem worse. It might be the only answer. And I think sepsis is a great example of this, where by intubating early, I can remove the need of, there's a metabolic demand of the diaphragm, and you know, just the act of breathing creates a metabolic demand. So if I can paralyze you, I can sedate you, paralyze you, and then take that demand away, that might help the overall shock state. But it comes at a cost, and that's to preload. So you just have to be aware of the physiology and ideally intervene in advance. So this is where, again, in sepsis, that's where I might push a little bit of, give them a bolus of fluid, or I may have a pressor going and ready to titrate up before I intubate so I can respond quickly. Because I know once I interfere with your preload and you reduce that preload, you're going to have a reduction in cardiac output, and that's going to cause problems.
As a critical care flight paramedic, you should never be caught off guard by hypotension or shock during RSI and intubation. You should always be prepared for that. You know, forewarned is forearmed, and it really, I've seen it countless times where people have been surprised when they push induction and reverse someone's physiology with positive pressure ventilation when the patient decompensates.
And I think we blame the medications all the time, the RSI meds, without considering you just changed your physiology. Yes, I'm sure that there's medications. There's some better choices in RSI meds than others, depending on the state of the patient. But at the end of the day, it's the physiologic change that has probably the greatest impact on the new state of that patient. The asthmatic patient is a great example of this. You get someone, they're asthmatic, they've got an obstructive pulmonary condition. They don't have necessarily an oxygenation problem. They have a ventilation problem. They can't off gas. And now I intubate them and if I don't set the ID ratio, I don't allow them to expire and get off that pressure, that you basically create a situation where they are in obstructive shock. Because now I have so much pressure, so much positive pressure in their chest, the blood can't get back to the heart. And there are case reports all over the emergency medicine literature of that young, healthy kid, asthmatic, that, you know, in theory died when after post-intubation for their asthma. And then when you disconnect the vent, you get a big exhalation of air. And then you hear the monitor go beep, beep, because now you've just relieved the obstruction, which was all the extra air pressure in the lungs. And now all of a sudden, amazingly, that young heart is working again. So yes, absolutely. Intubating a patient in shock is a critical intervention sometimes, and it may save their life. But no intervention comes free of cost. And so, yes, forewarned is forearmed. I like to say critical care medicine is about playing chess, not checkers. If you're not three moves ahead, then you're going to lose. And you're not going to lose. Your patient's going to lose. So you have to be thinking two, three moves ahead, or you're not doing your job right.
Absolutely. That was explained perfectly. If anyone wants any more information on this discussion on positive pressure ventilation and sedation and meds, I strongly recommend looking up Heavy Lies the Helmet. They do about a 45-minute podcast called The Induction Deathmatch, which is all about this topic. So quick shout out to them.
Excellent. Well, I think we've covered this particular protocol pretty in depth. The last thing we want to solicit from you is any improvements that we can make on the Army Flight Medic SMOG protocol. I know that you were the medical director behind the Naval Aviation set of protocols. Now that you've sort of laid eyes on the Army equivalent to that, what would you say that we did right with this? And what would you recommend that we look into adding or changing?
So, I mean, as a Navy guy, I always go Navy beat Army. So, I mean, of course, ours is better. But seriously, I mean, the protocol it's appropriate for the state. I mean, hypotension shock is a broad category. This is a very broad protocol as it needs to be. And it really defers to the clinical expertise of the critical care flight paramedics that are following the guideline. This is where I hate to admit it, but the Army is light years ahead of the Navy, is that you have critical care flight paramedics. You are training, you've identified the need for an advanced level provider in the pre-hospital setting, in their interfacility transport setting, to optimize the care of your patients. So specific to this protocol, I think it's recently been published, if it hasn't, but a bunch of us have worked on the new TXA guidance, and the TCCC is actually going to be a 2-gram IV push right up front. So the idea of hanging it over 10 minutes and, you know, 1 gram now, and then maybe 1 gram an hour later after you get to the next level of care, it just complicates it. And fortunately, some really smart people have done some great research to show that you can optimize the value of TXA by giving 2 grams, and you can give it all in an IV push, which, again, the specific guidance has recently been published. So I recommend looking that up, but that's something on your guideline that would change. I think the other thing, just in general, with all of these protocols, is I don't think there should be a difference between the Army protocol and the Navy protocol and the Air Force protocol. As the chair of the CPG subcommittee to the Committee on Intermountain Combat Casualty Care on the Defense Committees on Trauma, I would ask everyone listening, we've been trying for years. We've talked about the need to take all of the different sets of pre-hospital protocols and sit down, set them side by side, go through them one at a time, and make one set of protocols as a generalized set of protocols published under the Joint Trauma System, and, you know, DHA/JTS protocols, whatever you want to call them. And then at a local level, you can request for variances, or, you know, for one reason or another, you may want to do something different. I appreciate the invitation to this conversation, and I would love for the audience listening to volunteer, step up. Let's get a group of people together, ideally medics, because you're the ones using the protocols, with some medical directors from the different services, and let's come together and look at all of our protocols, and let's figure out how to standardize. So if there's not a difference between epinephrine and norepinephrine, then just pick one. So that way you don't have to worry about, if I have an Army medic moving a patient to a Navy helicopter with a SAR med tech in the back, that's then going to an Air Force CCAT tail to tail, the patient is not going from one medication to another because our protocols are different. We have standardized equipment. We're interoperable across the continuum of care. So I know that didn't specifically answer your question, and I apologize, but I hijacked the question so I could push my own agenda. But absolutely, I think we should have a standardized set of protocols for all of us. And anybody willing to help, please let me know.
I just want to say in there, a Navy doctor complimented the Army, and he did not spontaneously catch a flame. So I think there's some hope for inter-service cooperation in the future.
Just Trevor, I was planning on asking you to edit it out. That was a...
Oh no, that's staying. That's not going. That's going right up front. That's going in the header.
Well, we'll redact all compliments. Just beep it out. Well, does anyone else have anything to stick on?
I just want to say thank you. I think you guys are doing an amazing job. This is a great platform. I mean, to social, you know, kind of a new way, social media, whatever you want to call it, a way to, you know, an education platform is, you know, again, we can never learn enough. That's the beauty of medicine, is that it's constantly evolving, and having, you know, the work you're doing to make sure that our medics have have this lifeline to help save lives out in the battlefield is huge. So thank you for the effort. I know this isn't easy.
Thank you, sir. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Walrath.
Many thanks to Dr. Ben Walrath for joining us this week for this discussion on hypotension and shock. It was fantastic to have that depth of knowledge from someone who's obviously very invested in our education and our advancement. We definitely hope to have you back and pick your brain some more. Thank you to everyone who's listening. If you enjoyed this episode, or if you use this podcast in your training program, please drop us a note somewhere on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram. You can check back in with us in a couple weeks for another episode. Thank you for listening.